This is, on the other hand, a podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Well, April, we had a good time talking with Ryan Norris in our last episode, so we'll continue now with the second part of our conversation with Ryan. In this next episode, we'll look forward to hearing more from him about things he has in mind for upcoming depolarization efforts in terms of his own personal work, as well as that with Americans for Prosperity, the organization here in Arkansas that he directs.
Well, I'm going to move to a different kind of citizen. I don't know if it's a citizen-led initiative or if it's a bipartisan initiative. Partnership, I think, and this is actually something that came out of the recent September 2023 legislative special session. Governor Sanders asked for and received a tax reduction bill, but she also sought significant changes to the Arkansas Freedom of Information Act, and that law had received wide bipartisan praise in the past. It's been described as a national model, and many people came together on various sides of the political spectrum and voiced concerns about this, and eventually resulted in a much more modest, restricted bill. And the response to it seems like a rather rare instance these days of common ground between the two parties. And I'm wondering your thoughts about how that recent agreement across the political views might, in addition to the examples that you provided for us earlier, might bode well for greater willingness in the future for us to work together in Arkansas.
Yeah, I think that there is opportunity there, definitely. You had an interesting situation there. And I even had this recently at an AFP event. An individual came up to me who is very, identifies himself as Tea Party patriot. And he said he was up at the Capitol and he's alongside, you know, leftist progressives advocating against the FOIA bill. And so, you know, AFP had to make a decision. We have friends that were sponsors of the bill, and we had to come up with a way of saying, hey, look, we don't always agree on everything, and you can still be my friend and not agree with me on everything, but we're also not going to pull any punches on this. So we advocated for caution that you do not strip away the transparency of government. We always say transparency is for government, privacy is for citizens. And we have maintained that and been true to that, even when we're arguing, of course, for greater citizen privacy. I found it interesting that Senator Clark Tucker, who sometimes runs my bills that I have to oppose on the privacy component, did say, you know, Americans for Prosperity has been consistent because they've said privacy is for citizens, transparency is for government, and here they are at the table fighting for transparency in government. And I paraphrase a little bit there. But I thought that that was a validation that I have kept my principles intact, even when the disagreement is with those that I support, but don't necessarily agree with, on that particular issue. It was fascinating because, again, I think that horseshoe happened where you had the left and the right come together and come full circle around where they were on the same side of the issue. And they are on the same side of the issue. I've heard this phrase before, common ground, if not necessarily common goals. And I think you have that. So this will maintain as long as that common ground's in threat. But how it holds up when the goals become apparent will then be another further test of whether such coalitions last for very long. I don't say that necessarily pessimistically, but just realistically, holding together coalitions like that is very, very difficult. But there's these flash in the pan moments that give you hope that we can maybe build something a little more out of what we previous than a little better than what we previously had.
How do you see, what do you see as the difference between common ground and common goals?
Well, I think that the aims that one faction would have, say, for example, using FOIA, and the aims that others would have on using FOIA, there are those that would say, well, I'm using it for accountability on government officials so that we have a better government. And then some that would say, I'm using this for purely political, I don't like this person, and I'm going to use it to frustrate them and frustrate government. And, you know, I think that that's the price you pay, and that's a trade-off that I'm willing to have to keep transparency, that government may be frustrated at times because it, you know, I don't like to produce all those documents. I don't like to produce all the emails or whatever. That takes lots of time. That, well, that's just the cost of doing businesses in a democracy that is contingent. And it's critical that we know how our government officials are conducting themselves as they do the people's business. And so I think that's kind of where it happens, because in general, when you have something, let's say like FOIA, and you're in a partisan sphere, if group A has it and uses it against group B, group B doesn't like it. If group B has it and uses it against group A, then group A doesn't like it. Well, we're trying to keep a principal position of saying, for transparency's sake, it's good that even the things we don't like are there to hold us accountable. Yes, they're annoying at times, maybe individually, but it's for the good of the people that there is that window to look into the operation of government.
That makes
sense. I really appreciate the fact that you're focusing on values and being consistent in upholding those values, in even when they go against your tribe. And that's one of the problems we have. I think it's gotten so bad these days in government, is everything seems to be tribal, that mm-hmm. whatever your tribe says goes, and it doesn't matter what your values are or used to be, you go with the tribal decision instead. And so that's one thing I really respect and appreciate about that.
Well, you have a question about that, actually, Glenn, that you wanted to ask him, I think, related to kind of even how they communicate and the whole perception of misinformation sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, sure. So, Ryan, one of the things I've been asking several of our guests, because it just seems to me such an important issue these days in our culture and in our politics, is that we're having more and more problems with misinformation and disinformation. We've got social media, we've got partisan news sources, we've got all the interest groups, and we've got political leaders all moving more and more, it seems to me, at least many of them, toward exaggerated or false assertions, all in the purpose of winning and kind of somehow putting down the other side. One of my big concerns about that is that inevitably leads to more misinformation in the broader culture. And that means then when people start making policy decisions, when people start mm-hmm. passing bills, when people start deciding who to vote for, it's being based less on facts and sound judgment and more on these distorted tribal appeals. And mm-hmm. we wind up being poorer as a society as a result, with fewer positive resolutions of problems that need to be addressed. So, and then the thing that makes that really bad is it actually seems to be effective in the short term to do that. So it's tempting for both sides to indulge in that. And I'd like to know in general how you think we might reduce that problem, and in particular, you and Americans for Prosperity, how you engage in advocacy for your goals that, again, we've said are primarily red-hued in most cases, without contributing excessively to misinformation or mm-hmm. to increased polarization.
Yes. So you've hit on a critical issue that there is this misinformation, and it does seem to get worse and worse. The first part of that, and we're talking societally as a society, is we have to rebuild trust in the institutions. You know, we have to rebuild that trust, Glenn. And speaking as a red-hued person that sees, let's say, for example, media the majority of media are blue-hued and not red-hued, or the majority of academics are blue-hued and not red-hued, doesn't mean that what they may say may be true, but it's not coming from a trusted messenger. And I know that in communications, having a trusted messenger is very important. Being a trusted messenger has a lot of responsibility. And then we can talk about, you know, vision and principles in a little bit that I think that everybody needs to have. But rebuilding the trust in the institutions, and how do you do that? Well, you got to have some kind of consensus on what's objective. I've heard these great stories from my grandparents and my parents about like Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite and, you know, Paul Harvey. You heard from these individuals, and whatever they said was taken by everybody as being the truth and being the way that it is. In fact, that's what Cronkite, I think, sold off, and that's the way it was. You know, it was one of his sign-offs that he used to have. So I think that, but everything has become political. Things that you don't even think should be political have become political. Politics has become entertainment. And so you have this vicious circle, not a virtuous circle, but a vicious circle that has an incentive politically, in terms of power, in terms of profit, to provide to the people what their audience, what they think they want. And cognitive dissidence, being in a space to where who I am and what I think is not 100% adopted across everybody that's in the room with me, we've become a little less able as a society, as individuals in a society, to handle that. I've often said to some of my colleagues who said, heard that you went to such and such place with such and such people. Yes, I did. And I heard things I didn't agree with. And yet I live, you know, I sit there through that and I try to listen with an open mind, but I can still end up walking away going, hey, I still disagree with the point of view. But the one thing I do know is that you're not a bad person and you're not out to get me. And so rebuilding that trust in the institutions is important. Creating partnership strategies to advance policy. You know, currently policies are dependent on partisan majorities. Can we, the people of the United States, not come up with a way, or the people of Arkansas, can we not have some policies that can be passed red and blues voting for them because they're just good policies? And that's what I'm trying to work on, you know, here in Arkansas. I try to look for those kind of opportunities. How do we create partnership strategies? Because whereas I may be red-hued, I shouldn't always depend on a red hue of the General Assembly of Arkansas or of, you know, the U.S. Congress. There will be times it will be necessary for me to have the personal rapport with my opposition and the credibility with my opposition, that when my idea is in the minority, they will listen to me because they'll know it's coming from an authentic, truthful, and principled position. And so creating partnership strategies over partisanship strategies, I think, is important. Fostering greater dialogue, which I know Braver Angels is excellent at, doing this across the United States, it's very important. I had an epiphany one day to where I was watching the news and I clicked it off because I was becoming offended. And the offense was this: is I decided within myself, I would not let someone who I did not know convince me to hate people who I did not know. And so that opened me up to want to go out and find people who don't think like me, who don't run in my social circles, don't run in my political circles, and create relationship with them. Not just as a tourist experience, but to really understand what it is that is their fears and their anxieties that have them thinking the way they do and prescribing the policy solutions that they have. Because it could end up that I'm, again, may have a solution that they can be cool with and I can be cool with, and we both actually solve the problem instead of allowing the problem to fester because we're not willing to understand each other. So fostering greater dialogue, community-based approaches. I really like this, that I try to create scenarios, and I've got a couple of good ones going on right now, to where it is not a red or a blue. It is a it's a bipartisan solution to problems that we have. I won't say necessarily what those are, but it's things that I'm working on, the where when I hear from the left and I hear from the right, they both are complaining about the same thing. And so I'm trying to work on giving them, like, hey, do you know your neighbor over here has the exact same problem? Hear them out and hear what they have to say about it. And we can maybe come up with a more robust solution. So community-based approaches, I think, is very important. It helps also to, when we're doing that, to depolarize society when we're trying to bring our communities together. Educational initiatives is another component. You know, promoting media literacy, critical thinking skills. You know, I know both of you are professional in the way of digesting information, and sometimes things sound good but aren't true, and you have to be able to figure those things out. And there are ways now with so much knowledge at our fingertips, we can look for primary sources and look for, you know, authentication of the information to determine what we kind of want. We know that there are enemies just of us in general, the royal we of America, that use misinformation to keep us divided. And so learning to identify that, I think, would be helpful. And then just transparency and accountability, I think, helps us with the misinformation and the tribal politics. You know, holding our public officials and institutions accountable for spreading false and misleading information. You know, and I'm not saying that you arrest them or any of that kind of stuff, but you need to know that when they said X, but it was really A, I have trust issues now. You know, and so there should be an incentive towards truth. Not an incentive towards spinning the truth. And so those are just some of my ideas on that.
Well, I really appreciate your talking about the importance of media literacy and improving civic knowledge widespread. I think actually April had something in mind about that. I'd like to hear more about. April, what was that?
Yeah, I heard that you were working in collaboration with AFP was with Robert Richards and Kwame Abdul-Bey and others on a civic health index, potentially to lead to a conference next February. And I don't know much about it. I just heard about it. And if you could tell us a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, so working with is a strong term. We are sponsoring the effort, but Dr. Richards and Kwame are excellent researchers at putting this together. There's also a list of other collaborators and contributors to the overall index, and I'm setting back and watching this great work unfold. But the idea is a civic health index, looking at citizens' direct participation in the political processes through voting, through their political activity beyond elections, and their connectedness to friends, family, neighbors, and communities. And so there's some measures that they're going to be looking at. I don't want to divulge too much because I have an advanced copy. It's very interesting, but I don't want to, I'm not at liberty to share all of that. I would just say that in general, AFP is tasked with elevating the voice of citizens to those that are in leadership. There, you know, I work as a lobbyist. I'm a lobbyist for ideals, not for things, not for businesses or any of that. I'm for ideas. And as I go around the Capitol, I know that there are those that lobby for things. They lobby for their interests and their interests alone. So if they can use government to get a leg up on their interest, that is totally their, you know, their prerogative, and that's the way it works. But what we need is more citizen participation in that process. So I'm very much, we're a grassroots lobbying organization, getting more people to understand how decisions in Washington affect their kitchen table and affect their home budgets is important. How the changes that are made in, you know, in Little Rock affect what they are going to pay at the grocery store, or how much of a tax return that they may or may not have. You know, that is important. So the Civic Health Index, I think, is going to be a nice way to benchmark where we're at and then present ideas. And I know that some of the ideas we may agree with, we may not agree with. But the overall intention is that more participation is a better thing. And that's our position. That's why we're absolutists on free speech. We will defend anyone's right to speak their mind. You know, Jefferson, I will defend to the death your right, you know, to speak your mind, even if I disagree with it, paraphrasing again. But, you know, that's where we're at. And so the Civic Health Index is, I think, is going to allow us to have those conversations about how do we get more citizen-based participation. I sat in a great workshop in Gettysburg at the Bravery Angels conference, and it was about politics without politicians, or policy without politicians, and talking about the democratic assemblies that some countries have used to get randomized groups of citizens together that seemingly are representative of the various ideas, and having them come to a consensus that would either inform, or in some instances, in some areas of the world, they actually have the you know, the force of law when they come up with that. And I found that fascinating. Might not want to, I got to wrap my head around the force of law component, but I definitely think there needs to be more citizen engagement into the process. I am constantly thinking through what I'm working on and thinking, am I hitting on the ethos? Am I hitting on the logos? And am I hitting on the pathos? And the pathos are the human interest stories. Those are the citizen stories that move someone. I could have someone from, you know, the greatest think tank on the planet call me and say, hey, Ryan, you're a legislator. You should do this. This sounds brilliant. The academics is, you know, there. The research is there. All of it's put together for you. This is the brilliant way to go. And I'm like, I don't know about that. But I get a story from somebody within my district who says they're struggling with this particular issue. That right there gets my attention. And I think that's kind of an example of how important more participation from everyday citizens is to this process. And we just don't have enough of it. You know, even on our side, we build community all the time, but I never feel like there's enough people that really understand how powerful their voice could be if they would, you know, present it up higher than just Facebook warrior or social media, you know, fights that they have, or just going to their echo chambers and saying the same things over and over again. Let your legislators know. And the Civic Health Index, I think, is going to point to some of those ways that we can do that.
You know, those citizens assemblies that you're talking about, actually, I'm having my students read some work about that, mostly in Europe, where that's been done. I would love to be able to see some of that work being done in Arkansas. I'm not quite sure where to even start, though. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of areas that could be helpful. And the way that they structure them, they kind of structure them in the way that Braver Angels does, in a representation using our terms, of reds and blues. And therefore, what comes out of it has validity. It has trusted messengers that contributed to the crafting of what the solution is. And so there's lots of areas, I think, that you could use that in. I think that potentially areas of criminal justice, like criminal justice particularly, seems to be based sometimes on research, but mostly on the emotive feelings we have about somebody's bad. We're going to lock them away. Well, what do the people actually think? Because they don't contribute a massive amount into that conversation. And those that do are usually the formerly incarcerated or the incarcerated, who then's motives are suspect by the legislators. What would happen if the people have asked me, Ryan, why do you work on criminal justice? You've never been criminal, you know, been involved in criminal justice. I'm like, yes, but I understand the system enough to know that I don't ever want to have to go through it, because I'm not sure that I would get a fair shake on that. The system is the system, and it doesn't care that I'm Ryan Norris. It doesn't care that I have this type of history or background or whatever that may be. It's going to just say, did you or did you not? And then it's going to get that right only a certain percentage of the time. I don't want to go through that kind of system. So therefore, before that would ever happen, I would love to see it reformed so I have a better shot at justice and not just, you know, going through a legal system. We have a legal system, not necessarily a justice system in my mind. Hearing from those that are not justice involved, but could have the thought experiment done in a citizen's assembly of, well, what would we like our judicial to look like? What would we like our law enforcement to look like? And then create that. I think that could be an interesting space to start.
You know, there's people that do this kind of work at the local level. I think about the work that Martine Carcasson's doing in Fort Collins at Colorado State University with the Center for Public Deliberation. And they bring together a random group of citizens to try to come up with ways of dealing with a particular thorny issue or what he would call a wicked problem in the community, and then they prepare a report for the people who make the decisions to actually consider. Yes. In some ways, that seems similar to what you do with AFP, with the work that you've done with the Education Summit. And otherwise, I just don't know if you all are getting the grassroots people together in a room, or if it's more leaders and experts in the room.
Yeah. In general, it's the leaders of organizations. But we do have, you know, we'll have like parents who will get involved in these kind of things. And that's generally what we attempt to do as well, is that you can't, sometimes people paint us as, oh, you're the pro-business people. I'm like, no. We're pro free markets, which means that you don't give one advantage to the other. You create a voluntary exchange system in which each side feels that they got the better of the deal. You know, I recently paid to have some trees done in my yard, and it sounded like a lot of money. It was a lot of money to me, but is what I was willing to pay. Now this, the person that charged me based on what I was willing to pay. And it's something that I couldn't do. I didn't have the equipment for it. And I felt like, wow, I got the better of the deal actually on this. And he's walking away going, I just made a ton of money per hour in the few hours that I was there doing this work for Ryan, but I don't feel cheated in that. I'm happy to have done that. And so I bring this up to say that you have to represent both those with a voice at times. They have that usually, but for us, really focusing in on that grassroots component, the citizen that doesn't feel they have a voice, that they can't overcome the stakeholders or the institutionalized organizations that already have the ear of those in power and in leadership. That is my passion, is how do I get more of those voices out there? Because when you hear stories, you know, about how this policy is keeping food off the table of this family for no real reason other than an arbitrary number that somebody wrote into a bill, and you're saying, I don't think that number's right, change the number. That's the story that they need to hear. And so that's kind of my thinking in that spot.
Makes sense. Well, Glenn, I think we're getting close to being out of time here. Curious about maybe finishing with something fun. Ryan, any story about something interesting, funny, or some, you know, otherwise remarkable that you recall?
So it's kind of funny and remarkable. And it ties to the criminal justice side of things. I had every year, usually at the end of the year, nearly every year, we had a Christmas party, and we would bring together everyone that we're doing business with. And the funny part of it is that no one knew the other side. And so I had this room filled with 60 some people who everybody thought that they're all on the same side, but they were so politically different and involved that I'm sitting there going, if everybody knew how everybody probably voted or thought about policy, this room would probably erupt in a fight. But they didn't. They were there around having a good time, having great dialogue. Seamless evening of just great collaboration. I saw people holding conversations with the other. I'm like, if she knew what his thoughts was on the thing that in that impacts her the most, and he the same, they probably would not be having this cordial of a conversation. But I think it highlights that when you strip away all of these things that are kind of foistered upon us about our political labeling, et cetera, and just get to know each other as human beings, that then when that human dignity component is that, you know, hey, I think that you're a good person and you care about things, and I'm trying to be a good person, and I care about things, and I don't want to hurt you, and I get the feeling you don't want to hurt me. I think in those kinds of that sets up the opportunity for the world that I think Braver Angels and Americans for Prosperity would like to see: greater collaboration and citizenship, and not this divisiveness, tribalism that's seemingly tearing our processes apart.
That's
a great story.
Yeah. And I think that's what we are both trying to do, is really, you know, base things on values and treat other people with some degree of reason and respect, because most people, if you dig down, not everybody, but most people really are decent people, and you can work with them. But to start, you have to talk, and you maybe even more important talk, you have to listen. Right.
Yes.
So, yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Ryan. I really appreciate being on our podcast again. It was just a great conversation. Really appreciate what you had to say, the work you're doing. I look forward to finding those areas where we have agreement and working together on it. I think it's going to be great. So thanks again for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
We hope our listeners enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Ryan Norris. Be sure to check out the first part of this two-part conversation we had with Ryan, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. And you can find those on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website. And that's at the address arkansas.braverangels.org. Again, that's arkansas.braverangels.org. Or you can find our podcast on many popular podcast sites.
So when you visit our website, in addition to finding links to all our episodes, you'll also find a link where you can email us at otherhandar@gmail.com, and you can then provide us with feedback about the program or suggest speakers we might want to have for you.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.